Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. What are your first thoughts when you think of a place like Papua New Guinea? For most of us, we think of old National Geographic portrayals of indigenous peoples living a subsistence existence, unspoiled natural ecosystems, and a simpler time. Well, that's the mindset that anthropologist Paige West, who's worked and lived in Papua New Guinea for over 20 years, would like to eradicate. For that attitude, she says, inherently devalues the people and environment in which they live. West is a professor of anthropology at Barnard College and Columbia University and the chair of Columbia's Ecology and Culture University Seminar, who's interested in the relationship between societies and their environments. And in Papua New Guinea, she's written about the linkages between environmental conservation and international development, creation of commodities and consumption, the social impact of climate change, and the dispossession of indigenous people. Her books include examining how conservation efforts, coffee farming, mineral extraction, and international surfing getaways have affected local populations. She's the University of Tulsa's Phi Beta Kappa visiting scholar, and she'll be speaking and lecturing Monday evening at 7 o'clock in Chapman Hall on the TU campus on dispossession, racism, and the environment. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Paige West, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
For over 20 years, you've been working with the indigenous people of Papua New Guinea. And it seems like from your most recent book, you've been watching how so many outsiders will come to this place to either preserve, conserve, modernize, or educate people within the country. They really kind of step on their own toes there because it seems like they don't really help the people they say they're there to serve. Why is that?
Well, I think lots of people leave their homes wanting to do good in the world. And Papua New Guinea is a place where we see people coming to do environmental conservation projects, coming to do economic development projects, coming to take part in ecotourism ventures, things like that. And in their zeal to do something positive, they often overlook the history of dispossession that has happened in a place like Papua New Guinea. And so they don't think carefully about the kinds of rhetorics that they employ when they talk about the place or they talk about the people and how those rhetorics might have a negative effect that they had never imagined. So they don't think about the potential unintended consequences of some of their actions and some of the ways that they speak about the place and the people.
Give us an example.
So environmental conservation is a great example. There's so many people that want to do great work in conserving biological diversity and in creating conditions where we can have robust populations of endangered species. They might, for example, go to a place like Papua New Guinea and look at an ecosystem or look at a species and think, okay, this is something that we're super interested in from a scientific point of view or from a good conservation point of view. It's a charismatic species or it's a species that we know is endemic to Papua New Guinea. And in their desire to work towards the goal of conserving it, they might think, okay, so this system or this species exists in the place where indigenous people are hunters, where indigenous people have to grow coffee for a living, where they have to grow food in their gardens, where they have to cut down trees to build their homes. And instead of thinking about how their projects might have an effect on the day-to-day lives of those indigenous people, they put the species or the system first, and they don't actually engage with local communities to help them understand how they can have both conservation and the things that indigenous people need.
So basically stop what you're doing because we have to protect this animal or this species.
And it's often people who really, again, love the species or really understand that the system in question is super valuable, but they don't stop and think, okay, what does it mean to go into a place that is not my home where I don't have sovereignty over the area and tell people who do have sovereignty over it what they should and shouldn't be doing? A much more productive approach we've found in Papua New Guinea is to partner with local communities and say, how do we work together to do these kinds of projects?
In the book, you relate the story of a discovered, quote-unquote, discovered new species, like the tree kangaroo. Can you relate the story of this discovery of the tree kangaroo?
So tree kangaroos are these incredible creatures that exist only on the island of New Guinea and in northern Queensland, Australia, and there are 13 different species. And the one that I write about is actually one that a big conservation organization went in, and they did a wonderful expedition to a very remote place in Papua New Guinea. And while they were there, they encountered this one species of tree kangaroo. And in that encounter, in the blog post that they wrote about it, and in the news that their organization generated after the expedition, they talked about discovering this creature. And while they did not know that the creature was living in the forest that they were in, the local people absolutely knew it was there. They hunted it. They have traditional stories about it. They had a kind of social relationship with it, the way that lots of people all over the world who hunt have social relationships with the animals that they hunt. And so one of the things I write about is what that means to constantly talk about discovery, to constantly cast things in Papua New Guinea as undiscovered, and how it disempowers local people, but how it also kind of hollows out Papua New Guinea as a place that seems much more remote and much more undiscovered and much more exotic than it really is.
I'm interested in, certainly they talked to indigenous people about this species, and what was the reaction when they found out that the indigenous people actually hunted it? I could almost see them recoiling in horror.
I think a lot of the scientists who work in Papua New Guinea understand that, you know, the vast majority of people in the country live in rural areas, and many of them are subsistence hunters and gatherers and subsistence agriculturalists. And so it's not unusual when you have someone who's very interested in conservation for them to engage with people who actually hunt the animals in question. It's not unusual at all.
Talk about maybe one of the first subjects in your most recent book, Dispossession in the Environment. You talk about surfers that come to have an ecotourism experience. Explain what you found when you investigated this.
Well, I never, as an anthropologist, thought I would be working with surfers and writing about surfers, but one of the places that I work in Papua New Guinea is New Ireland Province. And New Ireland Province has some of the most beautiful reef breaks in the world, and so there's a thriving surf industry there. I became very interested in talking with these surfers to understand what they think about Papua New Guinean nature and Papua New Guinean culture. And one of the things that I found is that even though they're in an urban area, they're living in a kind of modern resort setting, that what they're experiencing is the primitive, that they're experiencing Papua New Guinea as if it is somehow in a sort of temporal past, as if it is not part of the modern world. And so there's this interesting slip or a jump that they take where they know that they're in an urban area, but the way they narrate their experiences there are as if they're in a kind of pre-modern era.
Now, is that something that the people who are marketing to surfers, they play up?
Yeah, it is. I mean, if you look at surfing magazines, which is, you know, surfing magazines are one of the main ways that people become interested in going to new surf destinations. These magazines really market places like Papua New Guinea, like Indonesia, sometimes places like Nicaragua. That's a new big surfing destination. They market them as remote and as primitive, as a way to garner more interest in them. The thing that I'm interested in with the surfers is how their representation of Papua New Guineans disempowers Papua New Guineans from representational sovereignty themselves. We see with many of the industries in Papua New Guinea a kind of representational practice which constantly articulates the place as primitive, constantly articulates the place as a window into our evolutionary past, and constantly articulates the place as impoverished and underdeveloped. And part of what I'm interested in with the surfers and the other people I write about is why they articulate the place through those lenses when that's not what they experience when they're there. And then what are the material effects of those kinds of articulations? What does it mean for Papua New Guinea to always be represented as the primitive, And how does that disempower Papua New Guineans? But also, how does it materially disadvantage them?
In your view, how does it materially disadvantage them?
One of the ways that those representations materially disadvantage Papua New Guineans is that some of the possibilities for advancement and for development that are accorded to other people in the world are denied to Papua New Guineans because of those images. And I'll give you a concrete example.
Okay.
One of the things that several of my friends in Papua New Guinea have wanted to do over the past couple of years are start small businesses associated with ecotourism or associated with the surf industry. And my friends have attempted to get bank loans. And the people that are assessing them for bank loans also rely on those narratives of the primitive. They rely on these narratives of people not having the capacity to actually manage money. They rely on narratives that cast Papua New Guineans as not really living in the modern world. And because of that, people are denied bank loans. And insofar as they're attempting to create their own conditions for moving forward economically, with the denial of those loans, they're then disallowed from doing that.
Is the capital outside of the country, or is it within the country?
Within the country.
And yet those attitudes exist within the country?
Yep, within the country and outside the country.
Is that from foreign influence, or is it just sort of indoctrinated in places where capital is, like bankers and things like that?
Well, so, you know, Papua New Guinea has an interesting history, and one of the things that makes it interesting is that in the 1930s, during the Depression in Australia and in the United States, you had a pretty large number of young men who went up from Australia to seek fame and fortune in Papua New Guinea looking for gold mines. And so during that period, they did lots of patrols, and one group of men walked across the highlands for the first time. And when they were walking across the highlands, they came upon the Hagen Valley. And when they came upon the Hagen Valley, this is in the early 1930s, they quote-unquote discovered a million people that nobody knew existed. Well, now, people there knew they existed, and people all around what's now Papua New Guinea knew they existed. But people in the sort of cosmopolitan rest of the world didn't know they existed. And so New Guinea hit the front page of the New York Times and other international news outlets as this place with a million undiscovered primitive people. And that lodged Papua New Guinea, what's now Papua New Guinea, it lodged Papua New Guinea in the Euro-American consciousness in a particular way as the last place with undiscovered people, the last place where, quote, people have never seen a white person, end quote. And, you know, that is connected to this much longer colonial history there. There's an amazing book by a Bougainvillean scholar, Papua New Guinean scholar from Bougainville Island, named Regis Tove Stella. It's called Imagining the Other. And in that book, he works through colonial representations from the 1700s up until decolonization in the 1970s, colonial representations of Papua New Guineans and Melanesians more generally. And he writes about the way in which those representations constantly cast people there as childlike, as overtly sexual, as exotic, as dangerous, as a bit ridiculous in their unsophisticated lack of modern understanding. And one of the things that I show in my work is how those representations are still the representations used to write about and talk about Papua New Guineans by many people. I argue that there's never really been an epistemic break between those colonial ways of apprehending the place and its people and the contemporary ways of apprehending the place and its people.
So the colonial attitude still is prevalent.
The colonial way of understanding and representing people, I would say, is definitely still prevalent. And you see it in lots of different avenues. So you see it in environmental conservation. You see it in the tourism industry. You see it in the world of development. And you see it in the world of resource extraction.
My guest today is Paige West, a professor of anthropology at Barnard College and Columbia University. She's chair of Columbia's Ecology and Culture University Seminar. She's the author of several books, most recently Dispossession and the Environment, Rhetoric and Inequality in Papua New Guinea, and she'll be the University of Tulsa's Phi Beta Kappa visiting scholar. She'll be lecturing Monday evening at 7 o'clock in Chapman Hall on the TU campus. One of the things you have done is founded an NGO to promote and expand the number of Papua New Guinean scientists so that when, you know, conservation or environmentalists come in, there are recognized scientists there and to promote their work. Why is this important?
I co-founded the organization that's called the Papua New Guinea Institute of Biological Research with a number of colleagues from Papua New Guinea who were scientists. And one of the things that we believe collectively is that for environmental conservation to be successful in Papua New Guinea and in other places across the world is for local people to feel as if they have sovereignty over the conservation projects themselves. And what do I mean by that? I mean ownership. We see from many years of work in both Papua New Guinea and other places that projects tend to fail if people don't feel like they're generated from local needs and local desires and what local people care about. And so PNGIBR really pushes to have more Papua New Guineans with master's and PhDs in the environmental sciences and the social sciences, because we believe that that sovereignty over biodiversity conservation projects comes when people have good science and social science backgrounds. And we've been really very, very successful. We've had a number of PhDs, many master's degrees, and people come home. They come back to the country and work.
Yeah. I would think that would be also really important now when climate change research, especially on a culture that involves the mainland of Papua New Guinea, but all the islands surrounding it involved with climate change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say every place in the world is on the front lines of climate change right now, but we really see some of the profound effects of it in places like Papua New Guinea that have both high altitude rainforest and then also low-lying tropical islands. And I think having Papua New Guineans at the forefront of creating programs to combat climate change, to build resilience with local communities, and to help people move when they need to move, I think that's really crucial.
Obviously very crucial when you're talking about, especially in low-lying areas, when you're talking about relocation. I mean, I can't imagine an outside culture coming in and saying, okay, you know, you have to move in a particular low-lying island or something like that. Do you feel like that Papua New Guineans are now empowered to make some of those decisions themselves?
So there's a wonderful climate office in Papua New Guinea that's staffed by Papua New Guineans, and one of our graduates works there, someone who did the PNGIBR program. And we really feel like having people like her name's Eunice, and having people like her who have really solid scientific backgrounds, but also one foot in the sort of local ideas about what's important in the world and what kinds of things need to be maintained in the face of climate migration is key to people moving in a humane way where they can maintain their cultural practices, they can maintain their cultural identity, but they also have opportunities in the future.
Now, your own current research sort of focuses a little bit on this as well. What are you currently working on?
I have a couple of different projects, and the two that I'll tell you about are in partnership with John Iney, who is from New Hanover, Papua New Guinea, and is my long-term research collaborator. He's the founder and director of Islands Awareness, which is a small marine conservation-based NGO. John and I have the shared desire to get about 10% of the land and reef area around New Ireland Island in conservation projects over the next 20 years. And so we're working right now with about 20 different communities to create very, very small conservation projects. And these conservation projects are generated from local ideas about what matters. So, for example, if there's a local cove that has a number of fish species that people have seen decline and that people depend on for food, they might come to us and say, hey, we'd really like to understand what's going on biophysically. We'd like to learn how to conserve it, and we'd like to work with you on it. We then go out, figure out scientifically what's going on, also figure out what are some of the things that people have done in like systems all over the world to conserve those species, and we present that information to the community. The community then makes their own decision about what they want to do. If they come back to us and say, you know what, we actually don't want to do conservation here, we say, yep, that's fine, you do what you need to do. But if they come to us and they say, we do want to do this, then we help them implement whatever plan they came up with based on the science and social scientific research that we gave back to them. And so that's one of the projects I have. Another project I have is a long-term project trying to understand change across New Ireland province. John and I have worked together for about a decade to really understand what sorts of changes, both cultural changes and ecological changes, local people are documenting and what changes they're worried about. And our long-term goal with that is to really help people to understand how to mitigate change or how to handle change in a way that is locally generated.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the topmost fears from the local residents, top of mind fear that you're hearing about there?
People are incredibly worried about climate change. They're incredibly worried about the increase in king tides. They're incredibly worried about the salination of the growing fields for taro and things like that. And so I would say the number one worry across island Melanesia right now has to do with climate change.
So king tides are, what are they, extraordinarily high tides?
So king tides occur when you have high tides anyway, when you also have weather systems coming through, and when you have a monsoon season, either a southern monsoon or a northern monsoon. And so in many ways, there's just a perfect storm, and it creates a kind of extraordinarily high tide. So a 12-foot tide when you might have normally a 5-foot tide.
And they're noticing that these seem to get more frequent, or they're seeing higher tides than normal?
Yep. They're much more frequent, and they're much bigger tides than normal.
And I assume with those higher tides, you mentioned salinization of some of the fields, the water,
yep,
salt water goes in further, it contaminates farmland.
Absolutely. And the other things, I mean, these are folks that live very close to the water's edge. They live in small communities all up and down the beachfront. And the last big king tide destroyed homes in, I believe, 18 different villages on the east coast of New Ireland.
Well, we wish you great success in your work. We look forward to the lecture coming up Monday evening at 7 in Chapman Hall on the TU campus. Paige West, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Paige West is a professor of anthropology at Barnard College and Columbia University and the chair of Columbia's Ecology and Culture University Seminar. Her most recent book is titled Dispossession and the Environment, Rhetoric and Inequality in Papua New Guinea. She's the University of Tulsa's Phi Beta Kappa visiting scholar, and she'll be lecturing Monday evening at 7 o'clock in Chapman Hall, speaking on dispossession, racism, and the environment. That lecture is free and open to the public. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Mark Dara.
Shira Ovidey, a Bloomberg tech columnist, has fallen out of love with technology. Ovidey remembers trying the original iPod and YouTube and being fascinated by these magical things. She felt like technology was the only remaining American industry not experiencing a threat to its existence. Now she has lost faith. She's not the first. No one can honestly doubt the benefits of technological advancement. Layers of inefficiencies and waste of time have been eliminated. Automation in industry has allowed machines to be automatons and not humans to be automatons. Our very lives have been expanded by better results in medicine prompted by new technology. And yet, many of us casually relinquish our autonomy and privacy to the glittering magic of our devices. Sean Parker, the first president of Facebook, now admits the site's original designers sought to make Facebook users consume as much of their time and attention on Facebook as possible. The program creates social validation feedback loops through the use of likes and programming that exploit how human brains work to keep people going back for more. Aren't these the same techniques those who program slot machines use? Parker wonders what this creation is doing to our children's brains. Nick Bilton, a former writer at the New York Times, reports a conversation with the late Steve Jobs after Apple had shipped its first iPads. "So your kids must love the iPad," Bilton asked. "They haven't used it," Jobs replied. "We limit how much technology our kids use at home." Walter Isaacson, Jobs' biographer, reports that every evening Steve Jobs made a point of having dinner with his family, where they discuss books and history and a variety of topics. No one pulled out an iPad or computer. Maybe Jobs doubted anything great would come out of a group of people staring and tapping at their smartphones. We are deceived, though, if we think technological disruption is anything new. Some of the great horror fiction of the Romantic and Victorian periods arose in reaction to technological advancements of the time. Within the last century, the widespread popularity of television was the first technology to truly upend American life. Texas songwriter James McMurtry sings about how his mama used to roll her hair and they'd sit outside and watch the stars. But he continues, "I don't think she's seen the sky since we've got the satellite dish." Like many families in the 1960s and 1970s, my family watched television virtually every night we were home. Our homework, meals, and chores were ordered by what shows appeared on TV each night. I stopped watching television in 1973 when I realized television shows are never about people who just sit around and watch television. I chose to live my own life. For several years in the early 1990s, my mother, concerned she had raised a social deviant, paid for cable television for my home until she realized cheapness was not the cause of my aberration. Except for an occasional news or sporting event, I still don't look into the maw of the great consuming screen. You and I can't know what effect the latest technology will have on us or our society. We are, though, living in the first post-television era. Our elected representatives in Oklahoma City are chosen by an electorate whose views are largely informed by cable news. And cable television, like Facebook, seeks to capture as much of our time, attention, and energy as possible. I say, escape to save yourself. Love your family. Learn the art of discussion. Become familiar with great books and music. Or read trashy books and listen to brain-clanging music. Whatever. Live your own life as you choose. But before this commentary concludes, please answer this question for me first. Have I missed anything, really, by not watching television since 1973?
Mark Dara is a writer, essayist, and a local attorney. He's a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa, and his essays have been collected into a book titled A Catalog of Common People. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.